I think we'll start. Good morning, everyone. So this is the fifth week of the series on narcissism. Just want to spend a couple of minutes just reviewing last week. What we talked about last week is that we can't just talk about it. We have to do something about it. So we started talking about the idea that even though people might not change inside, but we do actions that lead us away and reverse the trend of narcissistic behavior. Because we have the principle that a person is influenced by their actions. We looked at some of the symptoms. We had a discussion on empathy. We said empathy is not just making room for others or being sensitive to others, but even took it to another level, which is celebrating others. And we told the story of Aaron, Moses' brother, who was happy for Moses when he was appointed the leader of the Jewish people, even though he was older. Another idea, we also talked about the concept of uniqueness and being special, and everyone is unique, but really the foundation is that we're the same. When we think we're just special without being the same, then that leads to being very ego-driven. But when we understand that, we gave the analogy of the menorah, which had seven branches, representing seven different unique people, but all coming from the same piece of gold and from the same stem. Just before we continue, I just heard a cute little story, and this brings out a nice point. So there's a WhatsApp going around, and you know, as they do, and it brings out a point that giving, making room for others, going out of yourself for others, actually brings real happiness. So just a little story. The guy told it himself. He's his Sephardic guy in the States, and he's driving the Palisades. It's like a very, very big highway near upstate New York. And he sees like a commotion. He sees there's a bunch of Hasidic Jews there, and he doesn't stop. He doesn't particularly like Hasidic Jews. He tells himself. So, and then he turns onto this highway, and he sees another Hasidic Jew with the police. And he's obviously in trouble. He obviously has a problem. It was Erev Shavuot. It was there just before the Yontif of Shavuot started, which is a 48-hour Yontif. And he's on the way. He thinks to himself, you know, it's not right. Another person is in trouble. Another Jew's in trouble. I got to stop. I might not particularly like these fellows, but, you know, you got to do that. Okay, so he stops. And he comes out and he asks, and he says, can I help? So this Hasidic Jew has got a whole family there. He's got his wife and kids. He got stopped by police, and they checked his registration. You know, I don't know if you know, in America, the first thing they ask you is your license registration, and it turned out that his registration was out of date. He'd forgotten to renew it, whatever the case is. And in New York, what they do is they don't just give you a fine or that, they impound your car, you know what I mean? It's like and you've got to come later and redeem it and pay the fine. It's a whole thing. This guy's out of car. The problem was, it's a few hours to Yontif. And he was employed, where was he going? He was going to quite a faraway place. It would take like 2 hours to get there. He was employed to be the chazan for Shavuot, or some retreat that they have, right? And this guy doesn't know what to do. Oh, and what he was trying to do, he was trying to call Ubers and things, and no Ubers kept canceling on him. There was no taxi, nothing. It was like just frantic. So this guy suddenly has like this thing, he's got to help him. He turns to me and he says, here's my keys. Take your family, go in my car, and go. He says, what do you mean? You don't know me, nothing. He says, no, fellow Jew in distress, I've got to do it. Nice car. This guy was like a sort of a well-off guy. Nice car, plenty of place. He says, but do you want like a collateral? Like, can I give you my passport, my I don't know, my cash or something? So, you know, you'll all come back. He says, no, you look like a trustworthy guy. Take it and go. So he does. The guy jumps in the thing, he goes, and this guy takes an Uber home because he didn't live far, he lived like 10 minutes away. Walks to the door, he makes a joke, he says, you know, his wife doesn't often praise him, he says, which I'm sure is not true, but he says, he walks in, he says, I don't have a car. He says, what would you do with the car? He says, he tells him the story, and his wife's all excited, and the kid, she tells the kids, look what your father did, and all that. What I want to get at is like this. He describes afterwards. Later on, there's a second recording from the guy that came afterwards to say thank you, and he brought a gift and the whole thing. Very beautiful video. There's a gift where he comes and he's stands outside his driveway and he sings him a song because he was a chazan, and they became friends. Like, but what I want to bring out is like this: it's only an audio, so I don't know how to pay for you, but you should just hear this guy's voice. He said he had the best Shavuot ever. I'm talking about the guy that gave the car. And the way he's even telling the story, he's like just so bubbly and so happy. For what? Because he did something inconvenient for him and very risky for him. He gave away his own car. Yeah. Right? Because it's not surprising, because the research is that besides doing kindness for the sake of kindness and helping others for the sake of helping others and going out of ourselves because it's a good thing to go beyond ourselves, it actually brings happiness. It's like the thing we talked about before from Tal ben Shachar. He says we shouldn't pursue happiness, we should pursue those things that bring happiness, right? And giving, we know, kindness, giving actually brings happiness. He felt so good. And he was like on a high. He said he's never had such a chag. He's never had such a festival ever. Because he felt that he really helped a person and helped a community. Because he helped the individual, also helped the community, because they got their chazan that they had hired for Shavuot. So it's a pretty... I thought it was very powerful, so I thought I'd share with you. Okay. Before we go on, just this today's actually the last one of this series. As I mentioned last week, next week we're doing a one-off special. We'll do something special next week. We'll advertise it and put it out there. It's the 3rd of Tammuz, which is the Yahrzeit, 29th Yahrzeit of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So we're going to do just the end of the term. So we're going to do a one-off special. We're going to have a bit of coffee here before. Barista coffee, so come early if you want a coffee. And a bit of a morning tea, and we'll do a special. I'll do a special section on "We're All Leaders," inspirational lessons that I learned from my mentor, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I spent many years there, so I'll share that with you next week. It should be interesting and a nice way to end off the term. After that, we're going to take a few weeks break, and I don't have the date in front of me, but I will announce the date and the topic hopefully next week. Okay, so today, just want to. Go through a few more important tools and strategies that we can do to combat this trend of narcissism, but also to ensure and reverse any sort of tendency that we might have, which is a very possible thing. We all have an ego. So what can we do? And a few more things built on what we spoke about last week. And it's again coming out of the book that we've been using, The Epidemic of Narcissism by Keith Campbell and Gene Twenge. So it'll just be a few different ideas. So one idea is, this is an interesting thing they say, is about, it's a very COVID term, but we've got to stop the spread. You remember that term? We say that every single day in the press conferences. Yeah? Stop the spread, right? But not of COVID, stop the spread of narcissism. And they make an interesting point. They say that sometimes society sort of supports the spread. In other words, we give in, or we become impressed, or we use the entertainment effect, or we look at things superficially, as we'll talk about a little bit later as well, and we give in to the narcissism of people, right? So he says, once you recognize the symptoms of the epidemic, take action to avoid or stop this spread. They make the point, they say, for many diseases, quarantine is the first line of defense. We are not nutty enough to suggest that narcissists in internment camps. But quarantine seems to occur naturally. He says, narcissistic people eventually become isolated from their families and friends and professional colleagues, and their self-centeredness becomes apparent. But narcissism still thrives. However, because these isolated narcissists go on to find new lives to mess up, right? So a natural quarantine might occur if we became more difficult for narcissists to start relationships or get hired. We can do our part in this department. Don't date the charming guy who yammers on about his expensive watch, even if he's cute. Don't hire the confident, accomplished job applicant who wants to know all about what the company can do for her, but doesn't show much interest in what she can do for the company, right? In other words, it's interesting, because someone actually who heard the last couple of weeks online was talking to me and said that he's dealing with now a narcissist at work, someone that's heading an department. And he says, it's interesting because he's a person sounded like the perfect fit. That's what it is. When narcissists come, they fall into relationships very quickly. And they become, as we said before, they become leaders in companies very quickly because they are very confident. They appear very, very capable because they say so, and they say so confidently, right? And they're very convincing and very persuasive, and we kind of fall for it, right? So I think that's part of the reason why it's important to raise awareness. It's important to understand what a narcissist looks like. Now, we'll never get it completely right. None of us are blessed, I don't think, with divine inspiration that we actually know exactly what's going to happen. But we get used to, and we'll talk about it a bit later as relationships, we get used to sort of picking up the signs a little bit. Or we question and you know, we look a bit deeper, not just superficial and things like that. So one of the ways that society can curb the trend of narcissism is to be aware of what it is and make it hard for narcissists to thrive. There's a tendency is the other way around. In society, we often, first of all, don't know how to pick a narcissist. And second of all, we also, even when we think someone is like that, we kind of let them operate because we're scared. You know, people often, I mean, there's another point, but people often don't stand up. You have this in organizations, you have this in societies where people are incredibly egocentric and crazy and do all about themselves and things like that. And people, no one stands up to them because you're scared, because sometimes they become very upset, become aggressive when they are stood up to. And that's a problem. So therefore, society, we have a bit of a responsibility not to let it thrive.
You have a perfect example, Trump.
he's a pretty good candidate for narcissistic disorder, I have to say. Even though when he was president, he did some things I like, but nevertheless, he's nuts. There's no question. I don't like to talk politics, but he's a pretty crazy guy. The other thing, of course, is to limit ourselves from being immersed in areas of life which are purely narcissistic, like social media. Now, it's silly to say, you know, we shouldn't use social media, because it's not going to happen. Everyone uses social media. The younger you are, the more you use it. It is a means of communication. It's a means to do some good things. And it's just part of life now, right? But number one, people should certainly prevent young people from going on social media, and technology in general. You know, I just heard something so nice the other day. I was very, very encouraged. I forgot what the acronym stands for, but there's an organization in America, a Jewish organization of mothers, called MUST. That stands for Mothers Something Stop Technology or Delay Technology, something like Stall Technology, something like that. I forgot what it's called. Essentially what they do is they create a coalition of parents. You know, because what happens is kids come back when they're in fourth grade, they tell their mother, well, everyone else in the class has a smartphone, so why shouldn't I? And of course, parents fall for this, and it becomes a balagan, right? And it's very, very sad, because the iPhone and technology and social media is very damaging to everyone that's addicted to it and immersed in it, but it's particularly damaging to children, right? And they don't need it. They actually don't need it. It's completely unnecessary. And all it needs is nowadays, which parents are very hesitant to stand up to their children, just needs parents to stand up to their children. So what these people do, they go into schools. It's not run by the school, because there's always resistance. You know, when the school says yes, you have to say no. So it's not run by the school. That's the whole point, right? That's true, right? That's what happens. Yeah, the school mandates and it becomes a problem. But this is done by, and schools encourage it, obviously, but it's done by parents only. The meetings are only parents, and they join, they in each grade they go into, and they create this like coalition of parents that stand up and say, we're not saying that people are never going to have cell phones, we're not getting rid of all technology. One simple thing, they said, just stall kids from getting iPhones or smartphones, right? So just last week, there was a woman here in Sydney, she came for a simcha. She's an elderly woman. I think she's winding down now, she's going to retire soon, but she's the principal of the main Chabad school in Brooklyn. And there were a lot of people who were very excited here because she's been the principal for like 50 years. And she was Dina's principal, which was my wife's principal. We walked over to the Simcha. She's an amazing mind. She recognizes every student that was ever there. It's amazing. And so she spoke on Sunday morning, last Sunday morning, and my wife went for her students, for her female students, of course. It's a girls' school. And my wife went, and she was telling me something so beautiful. She was talking about the challenges of kids since kids started to get iPhones and smartphones in school, what that's done. Now, she's the principal of the high school, and high school starts in ninth grade. And she says now, because of this organization, they now have next year's intake, which is in a few months, because they tried banning this stuff. It doesn't work. They take it away. It just doesn't work, right? And anyway, kids go home and they on it the whole night, so it doesn't really matter if it's in school or not. I mean, it does matter, but it's not that effective. And this coming year, in year nine, which is the first year of high school in America, 60% of the kids do not have a smartphone.
Do not.
Which because of this organization, because of MUST. Yeah. It's actually succeeding. That's a huge number, by the way. Because last few years it was going crazy. I mean, you had probably 85% or 90% have, right? And he says for the first time this coming year, because it started a few years ago, but it was targeting kids in younger grades. So you don't see the fruits until later, right? Because it's very hard. The whole point was to target classes of kids who don't yet have a smartphone, like year one, year two, hope, right? And they did it a number of years ago, and now for the first time in high school, it's actually bearing fruit, where for the first time ever, I mean, first time since this whole mess up started, the first time ever there's an intake into the school where 60% of the kids don't have a smartphone. Which is incredible. And then they can keep it going, the momentum can go, right? So I guess there is hope, right? In other words, when people do things, we don't have to be scared, especially if we do it together. People need to join together and actually put a stop to this. What that means is that people aren't as immersed in areas like stopping the spread. They're not immersed in social media. They're not immersed in the celebrity culture. They're not immersed in the narcissistic culture, which comes through social media. But it goes for adults also. I mean, even though adults are going to use social media, but we hope that when you start using it older and we have some level of responsibility, that we don't get lost in it and we curb the immersion that we spend in it. That doesn't have to be 6 hours a day. It could be half an hour a day, whatever the case is. So we don't, because it has an influence on us. It infiltrates our brain. So that's also ourselves protecting ourselves not to be immersed in that whole culture. Okay. That's one area. Second thing is, let's talk about something else, what we need to do as a society. And we can all do that in ourselves as well, so that we have influence on others. As we said, there's a ripple effect, right? Is we need to reduce something that's spreading and exploding today, and that's the sense of entitlement. We live in a very, very entitled society, as we've said many times. So one of the ways that can be done is a positive thing that we can do and practice a lot, practice more within ourselves. Because again, when a culture happens in society, we think, we look at it and we say, oh, it's terrible, but at the end of the day, it actually affects us. It actually affects us if we don't, unless we protect ourselves, right? So one of the ways to do that is to practice, and they bring that in the book as well, but it's obviously a very fundamental concept and a Jewish idea as well, is to practice gratitude. We've talked about gratitude before. Why is that connected to entitlement? Because one of the greatnesses of gratitude is that we actually realize we don't deserve anything. It's not like we're entitled, right? When we take things for granted, that's when we become entitled, right? Because we expect to get up in the morning and to breathe, and we expect to have clothes to wear, we expect to have food to eat, we expect to have a house to live in, we expect everything, right? Because we take it for granted. Gratitude also allows us, first of all, to understand that it's a gift. Life is a gift, and all life's accessories are gifts. But also reminds us about saying thank you to Hashem in a Jewish idea, because it comes from God, and we need to say thank you and not take things for granted, even the simple things. Right, I've mentioned many times the morning brachot, the morning blessings concept, where we make these blessings every morning for very simple things, like for clothes and be able to walk and shoes that we wear and things like that, right? Because no one owes us anything. We need to just be thankful. And when you appreciate, we realize we're not entitled. We actually appreciate what we have. It limits the greed, it limits the obsession with these things, and so on and so forth. We know that in the Torah, one of the Ten Commandments, we often forget this. One of the Ten Commandments is Lo Tachmod. Lo Tachmod means do not, essentially, jealous, do not covet, do not want something that someone else has, right? It's more than just jealousy, it's actually like specific jealousy. It's like, I want that car that person has, I want that specific thing, right? Now, that's a very difficult commandment because it actually tackles the emotions of the heart. It's very interesting that in the Torah, not only, I think we've mentioned this before, not only are there commandments of action, which are sometimes easier to execute, because whether you like to do it or you don't like to do it, you just have to do it, right? But there's also commands in the Torah that govern the way we feel, which are more complicated because we have to get there, we have to work on it, right? So one of the ideas One of the ideas that the commentaries explain about being fulfilling the mitzvah of lo tachmor, of not coveting, is to remember that number one, we're not entitled. Number two, everything comes from God. And that God gives everyone what they need and what they're supposed to have. So if I have something and someone else has something that I want, but it's not mine. It's not mine means it's not good for me. It's not supposed to be mine, right? So we pray and we ask God to, you know, give us the comforts of life and we should be able to be okay and be comfortable and enjoy living on this planet. But at the same time, God provides for us and He knows what we need. And if He didn't give us a particular thing, we're not meant to have it. And because we're not, so again, it's all tied into entitlement. When a person is entitled, so then everything is supposed to be theirs. They're entitled to everything. Whether it's theirs, whether it's not theirs, whether they should have it, whether they shouldn't have it, right? So gratitude lessens the sense of entitlement. Gratitude makes it easier to fulfill the mitzvah of the Ten Commandments about not coveting. Because we just remember, we stop for a few minutes each day, like people have a gratitude journal, right? That we, number one, acknowledge the gifts that we do have, and also acknowledging them and appreciating them lessens the sense of being entitled to them. Which ties into another concept, which is spoken about in their book as well, linked to narcissism. Narcissism, the trend of narcissism, which we said in the last few decades, is very big. It also seems to come together with materialism, right, and hedonism. Now, it's an interesting concept in Judaism. Like, we're a religion that don't necessarily advocate for abstinence, right? We actually are in the world. We work with the world. We don't believe in afflicting ourselves. The Baal Shem Tov was very against people, except for the halachic fast days of fasting, because you're not supposed to destroy your body. You're supposed to make your body healthy. You're supposed to work. You're supposed to serve God using your body, right? And I'm sure I've shared this with you before, but in the Torah, I might have even done it in this series. There's a phenomenon that, you know, there's something called the Nazir, a Nazirite. We don't have it today. But in temple times, if someone wanted to go through a period of like sort of intense holiness, they'd become a Nazirite, which meant that they had to abstain from drinking wine and so on and so forth, right? And it was a period of holiness. And yet at the end of that period, when that came to an end, the person who had finished being a Nazirite had to bring a series of offerings, of korbanot, of sacrifices. And one of them was called a sin offering. And the commentaries say, why a sin offering? He didn't do anything wrong. On the contrary, he went through a process of uplifting this, of holiness, right? And the Talmud tells us he did need to bring a sin offering because he abstained from God's will. So things that we're not supposed to eat, we're not supposed to eat, but things that God allowed us to eat, he gave us the beautiful fruit, he gave us delicacies, he gave us things that we can enjoy, we're supposed to enjoy God's world, we're not supposed to, right? So at the end of the day, even though he wanted to go through a period of holiness, through abstinence from certain pleasures, but it was considered, like on a subtle level, sinful, right? Which is interesting. So how does it all work together? And I think that it's very simple. The concept is this, that we're supposed to live in the world. That's part of Judaism. Judaism's religion is not about escaping to some mountain and being detached from the physical reality. Judaism is about serving God in the world, by using the things from the world to serve Him. Most of our mitzvot, most of the commandments that we have are about physical things, up until even things like a mitzvah to eat on Shabbos, like, you know, to enjoy the Shabbos food called Oneg Shabbat and so on and so forth. So that's true because that's God's world and He provided it for us, but He didn't want it to be a tool of indulgence or a tool of obsession or a tool of hedonism. There's a very big difference, right? So yes, you know, we daven and we ask God to provide for us and we should be comfortable, and if there's a convenience, we should be able to afford it. But that's very different to being immersed and obsessed in it, sometimes primarily for the reason to impress others. That's not enjoying God's will. That's just expressing our own ego, right? So a while ago, someone came to see me and they were complaining about a relative, whatever the case was, and they were describing someone that, I mean, I never met her, but it sounded like a narcissist. And they were describing, I never heard of this, maybe it's common, I don't know, but about that had a child and they were making a huge bash for a first year birthday, and that employed a party planner. I think, come on, you got to be kidding. I mean, like, I didn't employ a party planner for my daughter's wedding. I mean, like for a first year birthday party? Like, I mean, like, who? Obviously, it's to impress others. It's not, I mean, the kid doesn't know any different.
The child doesn't know nothing.
I mean, give the kid some ice cream, it'll be fine. I mean, like, And it's but I mean, I mean that's an extreme thing. But I've seen like this crazy elaborate birthday parties for little children, and every family's got to kind of outdo the other and all this stuff. That's real, and it's happening a lot nowadays, and it's happening because we live in a society where we have, you know, thank God, right? And that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing that we have, but we've got to be refined people. I mean, there's a concept in the Torah, you know. In Judaism, there's a concept called modesty, right? But people misunderstand the word. It's not. It translates to lots of different things, and it goes back to a very general principle. Some people think modesty only means clothing and stuff. It doesn't mean that necessarily. I mean, it means also that, but it goes back to a pasuk in the Torah which says, "Hatznei lechet im Hashem alakecha." The person has to live humbly. The person has to live in a refined way. Walk humbly and walk modestly with your God. It says in the Torah. In other words, don't flaunt. Don't press. Don't get caught in obsessive indulgence, right? And it's very much linked to narcissism because it's all about me. It's about what I'm going to look like. It's about the impression I'm going to make. It's about my enjoyment. It's about pursuit of pleasure, where pursuit of pleasure is not a bad thing when it's part of life, not when it becomes the center of life, right? Not when it becomes my goal of life. So all that thing, but all those things are connected to entitlement, narcissism, egocentricity, self-absorption, and so on. So those kind of things, we need to look within our own life and just see where we can modify that a bit, and where we can improve on that front, not to give room for any narcissistic or egocentric tendency within ourselves. That's a continuous struggle sometimes, a continuous mission, so to speak. The other thing I mentioned is a very interesting thing, and that is we have to strengthen. As a society, again, we have to strengthen connections between people. What does that mean? So we've talked about this a lot, that the Talmud says that God designed the world through the concept of mashpia and makabel, giving and receiving, right? And that's how it works. We have to give and we have to sometimes receive, because we all have, the world is imbalanced by design, right? Because we have to be able to do chesed. There has to be kindness in the world. But kindness means that none of us have everything. So we need support from other people. We need to give to other people. And we also need other people, right? One of the symptoms of narcissism is the complete independence, where I don't need anything. Everything is there for me, and I don't need to come on to anyone. Therefore, I don't need to appreciate anyone. I don't need to respect anyone because of that, right? So one of the ideas is actually to pay attention to the fact that, no, we're not individuals. Like the Rambam says, that a person was not created individually because you can't exist individually. Can't exist in an isolated way. We were taught that we have to be connected to others, and we have to realize that connection to others is not just about serving me, it's about actually needing others. Now, no one wants to be needy. No, something like we said many times, people like to give, and they don't like to be needy, but we all need others. It doesn't matter when it is. It might be in time of grief. It might be a skill that we don't have, and we need to ask someone a favor to help us, and that's fine. That's why society is supposed to work. Besides the fact that we're supposed to facilitate the possibility for others to give, we also have to understand. We have to go through the process of being supported by others, simply to know that we're deficient, that we can't do it all ourselves, and so we need each other. And when we have that sense of community, we have that sense of needing each other. We also minimize that feeling of complete self-absorption, because self-absorption is the opposite of needing each other. I'm complete and I'm perfect and unique and special and so on, where I don't need anything else, right? There's a very interesting, when I was thinking about this, I just had a re-look at a particular verse in the Chumash, in the Torah, very interesting verse. In the story of Genesis, I often come back to that story. So we know that God created Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, and placed them in the Garden of Eden, the Chumash tells us, right? And in the Garden of Eden, there were many trees, and they were allowed to partake of all the fruit, but they weren't allowed to partake of two trees. One was the Eitz Hadaat Tovara, the tree of knowledge, good and bad, and then there was the other one called Eitz HaChayim, the tree of life, right? They ended up committing a sin, they ended up eating from the tree of knowledge, which, by the way, was going to be the plan anyway, but it was not supposed to be done that way. It was premature. We know that the whole lack of self-control there was only for a few hours. Adam and Eve were created on Erev Shabbat, before Shabbat, and Talmud tells us that if they would have just waited until Shabbat, they would have been able to eat the tree of knowledge. Okay. But then there's a very strange verse at the end. So eating from that tree of knowledge actually gave them a certain awareness they didn't have before, right? They're able to discern between, gave them self-consciousness, gave them a number of things, right? Which was destined for them to have anyway, but they had it prematurely. So then the Torah tells us that God says the following, Vayomer Hashem Elokim. Hena Adam, he says, the person, Hayaka Achad Mimenu. The person has become like one of us. Like the context is like God is speaking to the angels or whatever, right? And therefore, now there's a problem because now he's eaten from the tree of knowledge. He might now decide he's going to eat from the tree of life. And he's going to... He'll live forever. So therefore, what God did, he drove Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden. Okay. So, Rashi, the commentary, sort of the wording is very strange in the verse. God says, become ka'achad, like one like me. So what it actually means is as follows. God was saying that now that the person has eaten from the tree of knowledge, and if he eats from the tree of life, he will become someone that's going to live forever. He will become like me, says God, just like I am a God. He will talk the world into it that he's also a God. And they will serve him, right? And I was thinking, like, what does that mean? I mean, obviously, that like, what is that? What is that? So the commentary is explained like this. It's very interesting. It fits right into the... In other words, what Adam will do is, he will use the knowledge that he has. The knowledge that he has is a good thing. But he will manipulate it. And he manipulate it to become like a god. So I was thinking what it's really saying is, he's going to become a narcissist. That's exactly what it's going to be. Right, it's not the old, you know, say, I'm God and I created the world. He will manipulate the world to completely think that he's something special. Right, the concept of being special. And therefore, everything is there for him. So that's an interesting hint in the Torah, right in the beginning, all the way in the beginning of Genesis. Okay. Let's finish off with a very, very important side of all this, which is the biggest area where ego thrives sometimes. And subtly, perhaps with all of us, we just have to be aware of it. Not narcissism necessarily, but the very seeds of narcissism, right? And where it's happening is where the most damage of narcissism could take place is in relationships. And that's where we have to be particularly careful. On a number of reasons. First of all, as we said before, it's very easy for a person to fall into a narcissistic relationship, and it's very dangerous. But narcissistic relationships, where one is a narcissist, it's very, very toxic, right? But the problem is, it's easy to become slightly narcissistic in a relationship. So let's understand why. So first of all, it's easy to fall into this. In his book, Keith Campbell describes the following scenario. And we all know people this has happened to, but it's very sad. He describes two relationships, and he says they're actually both narcissistic relationships, although at different stages, and they look very different. So I'll just read it to you, because it's an interesting description. He says, Kim, 32 years old, lived her dream last year when she met a charming and good-looking man in a restaurant in Boston. He was everything that she ever dreamed of. Outgoing, confident, successful, and attentive, but not too attentive. First red flag, which she never picked up on, obviously. Kim felt special and beautiful when she was around him. Whenever they went out, she felt that the eyes of everyone is upon under the bar or club were on her. Kim was swift of her feet. Within a month, a new couple was traveling the islands and then a scuba diving trip. It was the most exciting time in Kim's life. And the rest of the story you can imagine. Obviously, it was a disaster at the end. Right? Didn't have to be, but I'm saying this one did. And it was a disaster, and it probably looked like the next story. The next story was someone who was really more into a relationship, where suddenly the person changes, right? It's very sad, because there's so many stories like this. This is where very often domestic abuse or, you know, abuse in a relationship starts to happen, right? So Amanda, 37, lived her worst nightmare a few years ago when she was diagnosed with cancer. And during 6 weeks of radiation and 10 months of chemotherapy, married with a baby daughter, she at first was happy that she didn't have to go through this ordeal alone. That was until her husband started to complain that her medical appointments inconvenienced him because he had to shift his work schedule by half an hour. He also commented that her cancer-induced weakness embarrassed him in public. And then she says, while I was at home undergoing chemo, raising his daughter, my stepdaughter, and our baby girl, he was off on a business trip cheating on me with a female co-worker. Right? That's a horrible, horrible story. But unfortunately, it's not only in the book, right? This thing happens. And he says, while these stories seem to be diametrically opposed, they are both about relationships with narcissists, right? So how does this all happen? And I think it happens on many, many, many levels, some more subtle than others. But it goes back to a point which we've spoken about a number of times, and that is, it goes back to understanding the foundation of what a relationship is, right? When we talk about narcissistic relationships, or one person acting in narcissistically, it's where the relationship is structured, where the relationship is there to feed an ego, right? And that's not what a relationship is. The foundation of relationships, we know, are not to receive, it's actually to give, right? That's what a relationship is, which is a good thing, and it's an enjoyable thing. But that's what it is. And even when it comes to love, it's about selfless love rather than selfish love. When we've often quoted the verse at the beginning of Genesis where God said it's not good for the man to be alone or lonely, it's because a person is limited. We are created as limited, finite human beings. And our gift that we're given, the gift of relationship, is not only marriage, but just general relationships, is to expand, is to be able to connect to the world and perspective of another, to learn from another, to support another so that we can learn from that, or we can become stronger from that, right? That it's about going beyond ourselves. Not just growing ourselves, but actually growing with someone else and expanding our growth because we've connected to something outside of us which is different to us, right? As the Talmud says, you've heard me say this so many times, they're just like, not people look alike, not people think alike, because we're all different. And that's good. That's a good thing. The depth of relationship comes from the difference, not from the sameness, right? So that's what relationships are supposed to look like, but they're not always like that. Now, in their book, they actually give an interesting angle to this. We've talked about it in a different context before, but it's a little bit similar. But I'll just read it to you. It's very interesting. He says, marriages and other committed romantic partnerships, and then he goes, says that this applies to all relationships, usually have two important factors. One is love, the emotional component that initiates the relationship and adds much of the depth. Normally, typically involves feelings of warmth, caring, and passion. And he says that early stages, particularly in marriage, love is often experienced as a passion. As the marriage progresses, it's based more on care, right? Not always that romance that was there in the beginning is always there. It's more about care, love, and so on. Then he says the other factor is commitment to the spouse and the marriage, right? Supporting, caring, taking turns, sharing responsibility, and so on. And he says the same thing on a different level, of course, applies to friendship. There's also sort of a closeness and commitment, loyalty, trust, and things like that. So to understand narcissists' approach to relationships, take every one of these ideals and throw them away. In place of love for another person, it's love for self. In place of caring, put exploitation. And commitment is replaced with as long as it benefits me. Right? So that's the difference between a narcissistic relationship and a regular relationship. Now, we've talked about this in a different context very, very often, and that is that in a relationship, there's two things. There's love and respect. In order to make respect means respecting and valuing the other person as an individual. And we've talked about that, you know, fish love, that story with the Kotzker Rebbe who asked his student why he's eating fish, and he said, because he loves fish. He said, it's why you're eating it, right? So in other words, you don't love fish, you love yourself. So the concept of and love is a very interesting emotion. Love can very quickly become a selfish emotion, right? I think I've explained this to you before, because love is I love. I mean, there's an I there. There's a big I. And there needs to be, because no one wants to be loved by nobody, right? So there's always a big I. But how do we maintain that the love is selfless and not selfish? It's about considering the other person, about giving to the other person. How do we make sure that it's like that and not a selfish process? There has to be a foundation of respect. Respect means to value another person outside of yourself, right? Valuing another person outside of yourself is counter to the concept of ego. Ego means I don't value anyone else. I value myself, and everything is there is for myself. As long as the fish tastes good, it's good. If not, I throw it away, right? It's disposable. So, you know, it's interesting. But this is the problem, right? The problem is why people don't pick this up today often is because people often enter relationships for the superficiality of it. See, the depth of the relationship where you learn from another person, where you respect another individual, you value another person as an individual, is hard work. Relationships need investments. Right? The overconfident, charming narcissist quickly sweeps someone off their feet. Unfortunately, among the males, this type of narcissism is more prevalent. Right? But the reason that happens, and the reason that people fall for it so quickly, is because they're not aware of the red flags, and also we're very attracted to quick pleasure and quick fun. Right? That's why a lot of these relationships start that way. Until life settles down and becomes more serious, and you need to be valued, and you want to feel valued, and routine sets in, and there's just a day-to-day grind of life, and suddenly it's all gone, and suddenly there's no care, and there's no respect, and there's no valuing, and it all falls apart, right? This is why this awareness is such an important thing. You know, I'll tell you, I don't know if I ever shared this with you, but, you know, I've married with 5 kids, thank God, but, and following the shidduch system, right? So our kids date, not for very long, and then choose a partner and get married. Some of my kids are taking quicker, other ones are taking longer, but all the same system, thank God they're all doing well. So, and I've always had conversations with them, right? What you got to look for, because it's an intense process. It's sometimes only takes a couple of months. And the theory is that if the basics are there, you work at it later and it will work, right? The question is, what are the basics? What I've always done, this is, I think, such an important thing, and I think it's important whether a person's following the shidduch system or doing their own thing or whatever, whichever system they're following, right? But I think compatibility of values are very important. So that's something they need to obviously look at. Communication, conversation. Can you talk to them? Does the conversation flow? Does it seem to, you know, you have like a common language kind of thing, right? Obviously, there's got to be a bit of chemistry. That's a given. But then there's something that I think, I mean, this is what everyone knows, but then something beyond that, which I always would tell them about, and that is this. I would say, number one, do you think, when you're talking to this person after 3, 4, 5, 6 times, whatever the case is, right? Do you vision this person as a person that you could value, number one, and you could really respect? I don't mean respect as a high authority, I mean respect as a human being. And also, do you think, and this is such a fundamental question, I always ask this a number of times while they're dating, is that, do you feel that person is genuinely interested in you as well? Because, you know, people can go out, and I've heard this happen, right? Where they can talk for 7 hours nonstop, and it's wonderful, flowing conversation. But when you reflect on it, it's actually a one-way conversation. You know, and because, like, often when people, not everyone's a big schmoozer, right? And sometimes when people go out, like, some people like to listen, they don't like to talk so much. And it ends up being a very one-way conversation where the person is basically talking about themselves, right? I think there's a joke, I forgot exactly how it goes, where someone at a date after a few hours says, okay, enough about me talking about myself, let's hear from you, what do you think about me? Right? And it's very telling. Or things about, like, when you go out and you order a drink, like, how does that person, man or woman, depending, it's my son or daughter, how do they treat the waitress? How they treat someone in the street, how they treat the taxi driver, the Uber driver, right? Just, you need to know that. Like, there's a person who's self-absorbed, or a person who really considers other people. And this is like, it's fundamental.
It was very interesting to watch that show on TV.
Oh, about the shidduch prize? Yes. Yeah, I didn't watch it, but I wonder if it was accurate. Anyway, it was interesting to me.
It's dreadful.
Huh?
It's pretty dreadful.
It's not good. No. It's critical. Okay, so that they put that in for sensation. I mean, that's
it
rubbish. And that's cool. That's complete rubbish. I've never heard anyone say that. Anyone who says it is cracked. I mean, they're right. Right. I mean, I've even in the shidduch system, I've heard so many stories where, you know, one person was taller, one shorter, and you just say to them, no arm, no commitment, just meet the guy, meet the girl. And sometimes after one or two things, like, they don't even see it anymore because there's connection, there's no connection.
Superficial.
It's very superficial. But yeah, but I mean, yeah, but most times when people have the right mindset when they're doing it, actually, hopefully, that's what I'm saying. This is what I'm talking about raising awareness, about looking beyond the superficial. One of the things that I've always, why do I bring this up? One of the things I've always been against, actually, is if I've been asked by other people, like, it's going really well. I mean, some of the people call me and ask me for advice, like, I don't know, I come, you know. So I kind of, I'm not an official coach, but I guide them along. I've had a bit of experience in, both in, as a parent and as a rabbi, so I guide them along. The question I don't like to hear, I mean, you can't change people's perceptions, so it really matters to the person that matters to them. I'm not going to force someone, I'm not going to, I would be very careful not to push something, someone into something that I want to do. But what I hate is, how do I know I'm going to be able to have fun with that person? I hate that question. Who said a husband or wife for fun anyways? Like, it's for a deep relationship. What fun? So what? So he doesn't know how to go play a game, so you play a game with someone else. You have friends, you play a game with them if you want. There's a very famous lady I heard podcast once, I forgot her name. Her name is Estelle someone, a French lady, who talks about relationships. She makes this point. She's not particularly religious, but she makes this point as well. Like, you know, everyone says, my friend, my bet. Actually, a spouse is not a friend. It's a different relationship. They are friends and they're spouses. Two different things, right? You don't have to be a friend in that sense. You have to be very connected, deeply connected. Of course, you share, you trust, you open up to each other, and so on and so forth. It's not fun. Life's not about fun anyway. Like I always like to tell these people who ask me these questions, I hate to break it to you, my friend. Like, you know, in a year or two, now you're going to have kids. Fun's kind of over by then, you know. I mean, you take a 20-year break after that. Like, I mean, they're wonderful, enjoy, we love them, but I mean, you get busy, you know what I mean? You gotta be loved, you gotta be depth, you gotta be so comfortable with each other. You gotta be, love has to grow, has to be enhanced, has to continue to grow. But it's not about having fun. That's not right. Ask me, how do I know I can respect the person? How do I know the person will respect me? How do I know we share values? How do I know we're compatible? Those are legitimate questions. I say, I'm always careful, even though I want to scream at them, I don't, because obviously, if that's really important to someone, I'm not pushing them into someone, something that's not going to happen, right? But it's a wrong mindset, that's what I'm saying. So, but it's a superficial world. I mean, in the book, they bring an absolutely shocking thing. I need to remember the story. Remember the story of Scott Peterson? It was a number of years ago, like a lot of, maybe even 20, I don't know, was it 20 years ago, 15 years ago? All right, very, very charming guy. He murdered his pregnant wife. You remember that story? Yeah, in the States. He was convicted of murder. He threw them into the water or something, right? Basically, she was getting in the way, right? He was trying to have fun with his mistress, and I mean, he could have got divorced, but that wouldn't have made him look good, so he chucked them in the river. I mean, it was pretty convincing evidence that they found in the boat and so on and so forth, right? No, hope not. Right, but he says the story doesn't end there. He says, an amazing tribute to the seductive powers of narcissism, Peterson, while sitting in jail for murdering his wife and an unborn child, received numerous marriage proposals. Okay, that's an extreme craziness, but it just shows you. But I understand what they're saying, because people are just blinded by superficiality, and that's a real issue. So, if we're talking about, right, if we're talking about reversing the trend of narcissistic behavior, this is an awareness we need to raise, and it's also a reflection we need to make in our own relationships. Hopefully none of us are narcissists, but we always need to ask that question in our own relationships. Do we care for the other? Are we prepared to go out of ourselves for the other, or is it about us? Like, obviously we all have our needs and so on, but it's about, relationships are about, real relationships is about the antithesis of narcissism. It's about making room for another person. Are we worried about the other person? Are we care? Do we want the other person to be happy? And so on and so forth. So, and that's, why is that so important? Because sometimes even kind people, as we said before, the hardest for them to be like this is in close relationships. We have to actually live with a person. It becomes even harder sometimes to really make room for them. It's okay to make room for someone on one-off. You know, someone comes to town. Oh, you have a place to eat, you have a place to stay. Please, for sure. Yes, no problem. He can stay. Well, I know he's leaving in 2 days. So it's okay. For 2 days, I can be inconvenienced. But when you're living with a person your entire life, that's the real test to humility and making place for other people. So these are some of the things that are other tools. I want to just finish with a story I heard yesterday. Just, again, going back to the point that we need to do small things, acts in the direction of kindness, of humility, of making room for other people, caring for other people, because it makes a difference. We never know, because kindness is contagious. So the story apparently takes place in the Yom Kippur War. Beautiful story. It takes place in the Yom Kippur War, where there was a platoon of soldiers that got ambushed, apparently. And one soldier fell they were attacked. Once such a fellow was wounded, like in a, he rolled over like into an area which was much more closer to the enemy. That for these fellow soldiers to save him would actually mean them almost risking their own lives, and they kind of hesitated. But one person says, "No, I'm not going anywhere without saving him." He risked his life, ran, put the guy on his shoulder, got fired at, but bullets, thank God, missed him, and he made it out. And he took him to an emergency, whatever the hospital, the army hospital, whatever the case was, left him there, and he left because actually he didn't want it to be known that he was the one who saved the life. He was humbled. He wasn't interested in making people making a big fuss out of him. Anyway, eventually this guy became healthy. He recovered, and he made it back to his parents' home. I think they lived in Petah Tikva, and they were a couple that owned like a little restaurant or something. So they owned a restaurant for many, many years. And he told them the story, and they were really fixed on finding the person that saved their child's life. So they took out ad newspapers, and they put up signs everywhere, and they like really went down. They said they live, this is this in their name, their son's name is so-and-so, they live in Petah Tikva, they have a small restaurant, and so on and so forth. And a couple of weeks later, a woman calls up or comes into the restaurant, and she says, "I'm that woman. I'm... It's my son. It's my son that saved your son." So they embraced and the whole thing, right? And then she looks at the owner of the restaurant and says, "You don't recognize me?" She says, "I'm sorry, I don't." No. Says, "Well, many, many, many years ago, I was a single girl, part of a community. I messed around. I got pregnant. There was this rumor in the community that I got pregnant from an Arab, and everyone ostracized me, and I was going through a terrible, terrible time. And I came into your restaurant, and I sat down and I started to cry. And that day I was actually thinking, contemplating taking my own life because it was just all too much. Or I was going to abort the baby, or I was going to commit suicide, whatever the case was. You came, and even though you were just the owner of a restaurant, you put your arm around me and you said, 'You seem like you're in distress. Can you tell me what the problem is?' And you befriended me, and you strengthened me, and you cared for me for a short amount of time, and I became stronger, and I had the baby, and I brought him up, and I kept him, and that's the boy that saved your son's life." So kindness is contagious. So we need to reflect on this. It is a problematic society, and the trend is alarming, but we can fight it, and we can do it, and we can do it by reversing the trend, by engaging in acts of humility, acts of kindness, acts of making place for others. Just a reminder of two things. First of all, again, thank you. That we're doing, the raffle is going to be drawn in 2 weeks. If you haven't yet participated, please do. Also, again, next week, the one-off, we're going to have coffee starting from 8:45. You can have your coffee at 8:45. Please come early so you can get your coffee. There'll be someone at the back here making a barista making the coffee. And I'll have some morning tea, and we'll do a special one. We are all leaders drawing inspirational messages from the Baba Chereva. Have a wonderful day and a wonderful week.
Thank you. The balance between self-love and narcissism. Having such a